wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick speaks with David Finkel, editor of Against the Current, about the war in Ukraine. Jan Hocken talks with Grace Dillon about women's history and the future. And finally, from the archives, a reading by Norm Diamond of a piece by Ursula K. Le Guin, also in honor of Women's History Month. Before we get started, let me take a minute to say how grateful I am for KABU. The programming here is a breath of fresh air in this world and in this radio market, and it's so important that we keep it going. Show your support for the Old Mole Variety Hour and for KABU by becoming a member today. Just go to kabu.fm/give. Help us to meet our $15,000 goal during this All Thrills, No Frills campaign. We're community funded and we need your support to get there. Just go to kabu.fm/give. Or text KBOO to 44321. Now to our program. First up, Bill Resnick talks to David Finkel, editor of Against the Current, and a prolific writer on U.S. domestic and foreign policy, talking about the roots of the Ukraine war, how it can be contained, short of world war, and how to revive the international peace movement aligned with climate action movements to avoid the great threat of climate apocalypse. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, David Finkel. Welcome to KABU.
Glad to be here.
David Finkel is the editor of the journal Against the Current. He's a prolific writer and trustworthy analyst. Hundreds of pieces on U.S. and international politics. He recently wrote on the war in the Ukraine and the global crisis. Its banner recites, Russia out of Ukraine, solidarity with Ukraine's people. No to NATO expansion now or ever. So, David, that piece recognizes the inspiring resistance of the Ukrainian people. It ends envisioning a revived peace movement. And in the article, you comment on how this war and its reverberations are overshadowing the absolutely urgent need to deal with climate change and its threat to human life. More on that combined movement, peace and climate action, later in the interview. First today, though, your article discusses the roots of the conflict and rival imperialisms for Russia, who wants to maintain their sphere of influence throughout Eastern Europe and Western Asia and stop the encroachment by NATO. And the U.S. and its off-and-on European sidekick, especially the U.S. with its far more ambitious project, it wants to reign supreme over the planet and over space, and that includes supremacy over China. That's sure to resist U.S. domination in coming years. And needless to say, it's a program to dominate and profit from its control of the international economy and its structures. David, tell us all about it.
Okay, obviously, a number of huge topics. I think this situation has dramatically changed the world as we knew it over the past 30 years. I don't think that's an overstatement. Let me just say first that when you talk to Ukrainian people, and I've been to, there was a great demonstration here in Detroit over the weekend, a couple of thousand people pouring out from the Ukrainian community. There was no anti-Russian chauvinism, okay? There were plenty of signs denouncing Putin, some of them rather off-color, but there was nothing that resembled hatred of the Russian people or anything like that. Let me also say in passing, it's very important that we say Ukraine, not the Ukraine, or just as we don't say the Lebanon or the Argentine anymore. It's Ukraine, it's Lebanon, it's Argentina. People are sensitive to that, believe it or not. It's very important to them that the reality of their country and their nation is recognized. And Putin's attempt to deny that has been refuted in a very dramatic way by the power of the Ukrainian resistance. So I would say that, yes, this touches on everything. It touches on the world economy, which looks like it's being reshaped. There's an economic war against Russia now. The sanctions are more dramatic than I think we would have anticipated, and I think go beyond anything that Western governments or the United States originally intended. I think the power of Ukrainian resistance has change the equation dramatically, and we absolutely do need to be in solidarity with that resistance. The invasion must be stopped, must be defeated. We can talk later about how it might end, but that's a big blank canvas at the moment. You mentioned that this is overshadowing in the daily headlines the climate disaster, which according to the new IPCC report is getting dramatically worse more rapidly than expected. It's crowding out things like the refugee and humanitarian disaster that has overtaken Afghanistan, or refugee disasters and displaced persons disasters in other parts of the world, because what people see now as the immediate focus is over 1 million people fleeing from Ukraine in conditions that are horrible and getting worse. So yes, it crowds out our attention on a lot of things, but it is right now. The war in Ukraine and Ukrainian resistance are the center of world politics right now in a way that is dramatically changing all kinds of things and all kinds of assumptions that we had grown to make.
Now, one of them, it has some, it seems to me, very positive implications, but it also has one immense negative implication, which is it's somewhat like the first war against Iraq and driving them out of Kuwait. It seems to me it's led to, it's got the potentials of triumphalism, of saluting the CIA and the military, of making the U.S. look omnipotent. And here it's not even been forced to send any forces in. It seems to me it's also, as you've written, empowered NATO. It's unified NATO the way it's never been before, not as a defensive force, which what it calls itself, having a point organized after World War II. But as an offensive force, right from the beginning, it began to try and undermine Russia and reduce its power and reduce its capacities. Tell us about the expansion of NATO and how the Russian elites have both used it to solidify themselves and used it to develop this nuclear weapon capacity to wipe out humans on Earth even before climate change does.
Right. Well, NATO's expansion after 1990, when there was an opportunity as the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact came to an end, there was an opportunity at that moment to wrap NATO up, no longer served its purported purpose. And George Kennan, the architect of Cold War containment of the Soviet Union, predicted that the expansion of NATO would have disastrous consequences. So it's been a constant provocation. That is not to say, however, that anything that the United States or NATO, whatever, had done in the recent past provoked this particular invasion of Ukraine right now. Okay. I think there are people who, the most insightful observers of the Russian situation, like, for example, Boris Kagarlitsky, argue quite cogently that Putin's invasion of Ukraine right now was a response basically to a deteriorating economic and social situation inside Russia. However, NATO's expansion into Eastern Europe was provocative and sooner or later bound to produce negative consequences. Having said that, NATO is now the beneficiary of a crisis for which its own behavior bears considerable responsibility. Putin raised the demand that NATO step back from placing weapons in the Eastern European countries on Russia's border. Well, in response to this, NATO is putting precisely those weapons precisely in those places. That's not to say they're going to go to war with Russia, nor is Russia going to invade a NATO country. But NATO and its military budgets, that is, the military budgets of its constituent states, are expanding as a result of this. And NATO may expand further, particularly, I would say, if the Russian invasion succeeds in destroying or carving up Ukraine. I think you're going to see countries like Finland and Sweden rushing to join NATO. So this is an overall multifaceted disaster.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm Hey Boo, talking to David Finkel, the editor of the journal Against the Current, prolific writer, trustworthy analyst, hundreds of pieces in U.S. and international politics. We've just discussed the significance of this attack on Ukraine and its people, its heroic resistance, We've just discussed the consequences of it, one of them being the strengthening of NATO, and especially, it seems to me, the strengthening of those forces who are not going to be satisfied just with humiliating Russia, which is dangerous in itself, but really sees the need for world supremacy. Anyway, my sense is that this is part of a U.S. drive amongst many elites in the U.S., particularly the old Cold Warriors who have been sort of sidelined for a while, despite their best efforts. Anyway, my sense is, as you pointed out, this really has world historic implications. But one of them is strengthening those elites who want to rule the world. And my guess is not only will the U.S. budget go up, but the Space Force that they just created and at least announces itself as the commander of space, as we know it, the satellite system, that whole system that circles the world and runs a lot of, that's very important in military and in just civilian and economic life. It seems to me we have to somehow come to terms with that drive for supremacy over economy and military superiority. What's your view?
Well, there is a struggle for the world. There's a struggle for the world. What has happened just now is that I would say Vladimir Putin has accomplished something that George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump couldn't. He's restored American leadership of the Western Alliance. And part of what happened here, I think it's been pretty well publicized, American intelligence, which had just a total debacle in Afghanistan when they simply didn't realize that the Afghanistan army was crumbling, they had a huge success in predicting Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Somewhat unusually, they shared that intelligence, as we now know, with Western allies, and they were able then to build up this unified front, which has resulted in enormous and rather unexpected unity around imposing really, really unprecedented sanctions on Russia, on an economy of that size. You would not have thought that Germany would sign on to this sweeping basket of sanctions. You would not have expected that you would see various Western political figures who have been put on boards of directors of Russian companies, that was one of Putin's ploys, are resigning en masse from those boards. You would not have expected American, energy corporations to dump their investments in Russian oil and natural gas. I mean, you're talking dumping investments of tens of billions of dollars. You would not have expected that. So right now, American leadership, whatever we think of it, and I don't think much of it, is a big winner. Now, going into this, the biggest emerging rivalry, of course, is the U.S. and China. And how that will all shake out in regard to this, will China really step in to back up Russia in this economic war? Will they start purchasing all of Russia's oil, which I believe is being offered at a big discount? This all remains to be seen. And first of all, I'm not an expert on this stuff. And secondly, I believe the people who are real experts are saying that they don't know yet, that there's a lot of things that remain to be seen. People who make sweeping pronouncements are probably, at this point, not the best informed. However, looking at the overall geopolitical situation, the United States, or as some of us say, U.S. imperialism, is the world's number one superpower. China is number two and attempting to catch up and eventually surpass the United States. Russia, despite its military, is really a third-and-a-half-rate power right now that's trying to get back into second spot. And I think that this situation is going to hit the Russian economy and the Russian people very, very hard and may very well wind up denting the image of their military prowess because the invasion turns out to have been poorly planned and is going very badly and can now only be carried through by massive brute force, which means mass shelling and mass civilian carnage in Ukrainian cities. That's what we're actually right now looking at.
No one can predict what China is going to do, but it's very unlikely, it seems to me, that China is going to give up its claims to Taiwan and the South China Sea. They're not going to give up those claims, and yet the Taiwanese and others are not ready to yield to China, and the U.S. is backing them, and the U.S. is, in fact, U.S. destroyers, Navy ships, the biggest ones, nuclear-armed, some of them, at least the submarines are, who are also active there, are coming into very close contact with the Chinese Navy, which is growing, and up, and they certainly have nuclear capacity in that whole area, the Chinese. It seems to me we've entered now into a much more dangerous sort of, I mean, this war has now created a far more dangerous imperialist trajectory. It's given those who want the U.S. to be supreme a lot of momentum, and they are not going to give up. There's no reasoning with them. It seems to me we can say that's enormously dangerous, and it really requires a peace movement in the United States that can stand up to the U.S. imperialist momentum.
Well, I would say, first of all, that neither the U.S. or China have any intention of starting a war right now or in the short to medium term. And I don't expect either of them to do anything ultra provocative and stupid, although they're going to continue to, you know, probe and test and so forth. I think it's pretty clear that people in Taiwan who have struggled and fought their way to basically a democratic system after years of struggle against a pretty brutal dictatorship established by Chiang Kai-shek when he fled the mainland to China. But anyway, they have a democratic system now, and they see what's happened to Hong Kong. They see what's happening to Tibet and the Uyghurs and so on. And so I think it's quite clear that people in Taiwan do not want unification with China on anything like present terms. That doesn't mean that either the U.S. or China intend to go to war over it. It is a dangerous time. It's a very dangerous time. By the way, we're always under the danger of nuclear war as long as nuclear weapons exist. I don't think the danger of nuclear war right now is greater over Ukraine, for example, than it is any other day of the week, any other day of the year. I think that's an ever-present threat. I'm not more terrified of it now than I am any other time. However, we do need a strong and principled anti-war movement. We don't have that now. I would say the greatest peace movement in the world right now, let's be honest, are the people in Russia who are going out into the streets in a police state, you know, atmosphere to protest against the war. That is the world's leading edge of the peace movement right now. And we need to, you know, identify and really amplify those voices. That's the international anti-war movement that we actually have. Too much of the peace movement in this country, first of all, were not very strong, and many people got disoriented by more or less correctly understanding what's everything that's wrong with NATO, but not recognizing the kind of danger represented by Putin's aggressive nationalist chauvinism, which, by the way, if you really want to look at it in a broader context, what Putin represents is a species of white Christian nationalism. That's why the far right all over Europe and some of the far right in this country had gravitated toward Putin, although they have to change their stance now that Putin has invaded. But that's how you have to understand Putin. And too much of the peace movement in this country, it's good they recognize that NATO is aggressive and imperialist and all the rest of it, but they didn't grasp the other side of the equation nearly soon enough, and some of them still don't.
They think, we really do need the peace movement. I think that we're going to get a large enough peace movement. It'll have to be based on using the peace dividend, that is the vast sums around the world, and particularly the U.S., that dwarfs any other country, in fact, any other 10 countries, I believe, in spending on military hardware and all of the rest. A peace movement could combine with climate action movements to demand an end to the militarism and a realignment of the economy and public funding to deal with impending, looming climate disaster. My guess is, Dave, you agree with that, but We'll have another interview soon, though, talking about, again, some of the other implications of the war and, in fact, the potential for the U.S. and international peace movements. Dave Finkel, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Great. Glad to be here.
No End by DJ Woody here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, and Bill Resnick talking to David Finkel, editor of Against the Current magazine, on Ukraine and the need for a combined peace and climate action movement to build a peaceful, sustainable, and democratic world. Up next, Jan Hocken and Grace Dillon. But first, let me remind you of the commitment which many KBOO listeners have made to the future of this essential community radio station. In fact, 80% of our funding comes from listeners, and you can join them by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. Or just text KBOO to 44321. Check out all the great programming specials we've put together for you at kboo.fm/thrills. And now Jan Hocken talks with Grace Dillon about history and emancipatory visions of the future. Dillon is professor of Indigenous Nations at Portland State University. She edited the anthology Walking the Clouds, Indigenous Science Fiction, and coined the term Indigenous Futurisms, paying homage to Afrofuturism. While uncovering history is vital to the struggle for sovereignty and social justice, Dillon explains how Indigenous people are often cast by white settler culture as buried in the past or frozen in time. Here's Jan Hocken and Grace Dillon for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Welcome again to KBOO, Grace Dillon.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on again.
Well, the last time you were on the Old Mole, you talked about your work as a consultant on the film Antlers and how you weighed in on the director's use of Indigenous imagery and storytelling. You're perhaps best known for coining the term Indigenous Futurisms, a literary film and arts movement that pays homage to Afrofuturism. In your introduction to the anthology Walking the Clouds, you describe recurring themes and ways of thinking about Native history and worldviews and visions of the future in works associated with Indigenous Futurisms. So let's start by talking about this term, what it encompasses and what it means.
Well, first of all, I really love John Reeder, a friend of mine and a professor at the University of Hawaii, who wrote about how genre fiction really isn't genre fiction, but that rather they are families of resemblances. And I've always really loved that expression, families of resemblances, because no matter how, like in Walking the Clouds, I went ahead and gave a few categories that were just emerging from what I was reading and from what the authors themselves were describing, because that was a huge part of that anthology, was to actually get their own input about what they thought science fiction meant, seeing themselves as indigenous futurisms, what that meant to them. And so there's some really wonderful thinking going on with that. Indigenous futurisms like Afrofuturism, African futurisms, Chicana Latina futurisms, or Latinx futurisms is the more recent terming, Gulf futurisms, Middle East, Israeli futurisms, Asian futurisms, all of those to me are indebted to Afrofuturism, and in particular, Alondra Nelson, who now works for President Joe Biden in an official capacity connected to health. But she was the one who edited in 2002 this amazing scholarly input from Africana scholars from all over, taking together what they had exchanged online, because it really started in online forums and discussions there. And then they created in Social Text the first edited collection of scholarship on Afrofuturism. And I was reading that just as I had become tenure track, thanks to the graciousness of Ursa K. Le Guin, who really mentored me, supported me, and wrote a letter for me to get a science fiction tenure track job at PSU. And at the time, I was, you know, reading all different kinds of science fiction, but was really struck by the hesitancy, actually, to bring in indigenous writings into either the fantastic fields, the horror fields, or science fiction fields. And all of that, by the way, when it's combined, is really speculative literature, horror, fantasy, and science fiction. And at this point, it's become so experimented with that those strands of horror, SF, and the fantastic often can appear in the same story or novel.
SF meaning science fiction.
Yeah, that's the scholarly expression for it.
Right. Seems like part of a thread that runs through these traditions of oppressed peoples who are claiming a vision of the future is to break with a Eurocentric vision of modernity and heroic narratives, and where Africanness and indigenousness is both kind of a backdrop to white, particularly white male stories, but also are associated with the past, sometimes a tragic past, but nonetheless the past. And you do talk about that in your introduction. This is not about only or primarily reclaiming a tragic history, but challenging even many of those constructions of indigenousness. Can you speak to that, which is kind of a political dimension of it?
Well, first of all, just as we are in land claim acknowledgments that are starting to be seen around universities all over and many different professional institutions, the important thing that sometimes is left out is our own presence, our own dynamic presence. And so for us, just as it is the case for many BIPOC communities and co-future communities, we ourselves are, and Gerald Visner, who's Anishinaabe like I am, termed it survivance. And it's both theory and process and method at the same time, as all of our theories are. And he suggests that we actually overgo tragedy dominance and victimry by celebrating through storytelling and natural reason. And natural reason is often connected to anything connected to being outside or what we call normal or outside, but in the English language is referred to as nature. And so within that natural reasoning and that storytelling, and by the way, I grew up with all of our stories about science. Anything that was science, I learned through stories of certain animals, animal persons, just all different kinds of trickster stories with sly wit. But in the process of that, learning the actual Geekandasawan or the everyday science that we live with, like tending and taking care of plants and things of that nature.
Well, yeah. One example I'd like you to maybe talk a bit about from Walking the Clouds in your introduction to the essay by Andrea Hairston, who, as you say, challenges us to examine our feelings about ghost phenomena, those uncanny presences that we occasionally feel but cannot rationally categorize. This is perhaps ghost phenomena associated more with horror than science fiction, but I think it was of interest to me because ghost stories really are about the dead haunting the living and bridging a history perhaps that's unsettling for the living. Can you say something about that example and how it's part of Indigenous futurisms, and particularly around this notion of how our understanding of history gets projected into visions of the future?
Yeah. What's interesting about ghost stories is, yes, they can be very haunting. They can feed you with fire. They can make you dance and metamorphose into animals, as happens in Andrea Hairston's novels. But I'm also thinking of, there's a lot of intermixing of ghosts or ancient spirits, so that you can go from Stephen Graham Jones, who's Pagan Blackfeet, from his novel, The Fast Red Road, where there's a Indian country is set up for real as this huge, huge, huge territory that only natives can live in. Even anthropologists can't sneak in, although they try to. But in that case, there you have the looming, horrifying, taller than taller than taller, gigantic images of spirit ancestors that frighten everyone, right? And then you have in Sherman Alexie's story, he has a short story that is also in that collection. And he has ghosts there too, especially with ghost dancing. But he also manages to very wittily kind of undercut the figurehead for ghost dancing, who was actually an orphan that was raised by white people and was interviewed by an Irish journalist. So many, many, many forms of Indigenous futurisms have come out since 2012. And Darcy Little Badger, who is Lipan Apache Nation, a member of the Lipan Apache Nation, who is an assistant professor at the Seattle College just across the border there, has written, it's called A Ghost Story, Alotsowe, but it is also Indigenous futurisms. And then her sequel, or a book that went beyond that, is called A Snake Falls to Earth. And that just came out. And what's interesting about those ghost stories is that, yes, some of them are scary and some of them are frightening, but some of them are not like that at all.
Some are sustaining and strengthening, like drawing on, yes, on spirits, like, yes, like the ghost dancing was part of a resistance in this region too, to colonization, as I understand that history. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And so those kind of ghost stories bring in the way we interact with our ancestors, with spirit beings and with others. For us, Indigenous futurisms and all futurisms, including Afrofuturism, has this. Instead of the old cyberpunk falsification of body versus mind, and in post-cyberpunk writing, they've really kind of reacted to that and, you know, engaged in that a lot more. But where in cyberpunk, it was important to get away from your meat, away from your flesh, away from your skin, away from your body, and get into a mind that you could even just upload somewhere, right? And for futurisms, we have the complexity, the high context level of body, mind, spirit simultaneously. And so it's much like Sammy Schock, who is this excellent African-American and disabled scholar and artist who has written about disability studies as body, mind, and she makes it one word. And for us in our Routledge handbook, we're making one word, body, mind, spirit, to show that it is simultaneously all one and the same thing. And our sciences are the same way. We have Gregory Cajete, who is Pueblo and has written much about Indigenous sciences and Native science. And he talks about how our sciences, because it's not just one, our sciences are high context as opposed to low context. Because with Eurocentric uses of science, it's often low context because you're in a lab, you're splicing things apart, you're trying to bring it down to its smallest item and kind of toss out other things while you're doing that, right?
To maximize control, which often has the illusion of control of over the phenomena that's under the microscopic focus of science.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, though, that worldwide, sciences are changing and Indigenous sciences are actually making it really big. And there have been some really wonderful texts, like one that just came out this late January called Fresh Banana Leaves, Healing Indigenous Landscapes Through Indigenous Science. And that's by Jessica Hernandez. She got her PhD from University of Washington.
So some of this is breaking with certain dichotomous ways of thinking, Indigenous is associated with backwardness, Westernness with future, the future and scientific thinking and technological possibilities. So you're really challenging, or this field really challenges those dichotomies and reclaims and a kind of vision of progress in a way. What does progress mean in that sense? Yeah.
And so high context for us, as Gregory Cajete defines it in Indigenous Community, Rekindling the Teachings of the Seventh Fire, and he shows how our singing, dancing, ceremony, storytelling, music, drumming, all of that kind of thing is a part of our science. And so it's very much engaged with that. Now, the important thing is that we don't make it either Indigenous science or Eurocentric science. We view global scientific perspectives as all having value as you observe them and practice with them and work together. So there are tribal schools, for instance, that have nanobiotechnologies that they're working with, you know, where they're working both with organic and with nanobites at the same time.
So it would be a mistake to characterize Indigenous sciences as a rejection of the Western history of scientific thinking.
That's right. I mean, there are parts of it where we are different, but there are more parts where we overlap. And so it's the overlap and it's the consensus building. And even when we get huge grants from the National Foundation of Science, we are often bringing together indigenous sciences with an overlap of allyship. Let's say we work with a lot of allies that are, like our dean, for instance, is a biologist.
At Portland State University.
Yes, and he's worked very strongly to bring in actual positions for teaching indigenous sciences in our program. Like, I think we have at least three that do that. And then I teach indigenous sciences through the storytelling of indigenous futurisms.
Grace Dillon, thank you for being with us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you very much, Janice, for giving me the honor of being on this show with you.
Oh, well, thank you, and we will speak again.
Was My Way by Cognitif here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, and Jan Hocken speaking with Grace Dillon. Up next, Norm Diamond with a performative reading of Ursula K. Le Guin, though of course I would be remiss if I didn't take a moment here to remind you how important it really is to support this radio station. KBOO is in the middle of our All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, where we're bringing you special days of unique and exciting programming. Find all the specials at kboo.fm/thrills. KBOO is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio, made possible by people like you. Help us reach our fundraising goal. Go right now to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Finally, this week from the archives, in honor of International Women's History Month, Norm Diamond presents a performance piece by Ursula K. Le Guin on the non-recognition of women in history. Le Guin originally wrote Introducing Myself as a performance piece in the 1980s, later revising it for inclusion in her essay collection The Wave in the Mind, Talks and Essays on the Writer, the Reader, and the Imagination. Here's Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Did you know that this entire month is International Women's History Month? Women's history is a tricky subject because for most of history, women didn't exist. A more careful phrasing would be that women weren't acknowledged or were barely acknowledged to exist. But Ursula K. Le Guin, marvelous Portland writer who died 2 years ago, wasn't interested in being careful. She developed a performance piece called Introducing Myself, based on the irony of women not being acknowledged historically. In honor of International Women's History Month, and I hope in honor of one of my favorite authors, Ursula Le Guin, and with the double irony of me, not a woman, portraying a woman, who in turn is portraying a man, well, if that sounds confusing, You'll get it once I start. Just imagine it's Ursula speaking, though you're hearing my voice. And when she, that is, I, starts out by saying, I am a man, she's making a gender statement, not referring to the demand for racial dignity of the striking Memphis sanitation workers in 1964, where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. You remember, they too insisted, I am a man. So, here goes. Introducing myself. I am a man. Now you may think I've made some kind of silly mistake about gender, or maybe that I'm trying to fool you, because my first name ends in an A, and I own 3 bras, and I've been pregnant 5 times, and other things like that that you might have noticed. Little details. I am a man, and I want you to believe and accept this as a fact, just as I did for many years. You see, when I was growing up at the time of the wars of the Medes and Persians, and when I went to college, just after the Hundred Years' War, and when I was bringing up my children during the Korean, Cold, and Vietnam Wars, there were no women. Women are a very recent invention. I predate the invention of women by decades. Well, if you insist on pedantic accuracy, women have been invented several times in widely varying localities, but the inventors just didn't know how to sell the product. Their distribution techniques were rudimentary, and their market research was nil, and so, of course, the concept just didn't get off the ground. Even with a genius behind it, an invention has to find its market, and it seemed like for a long time, the idea of women just didn't make it to the bottom line. Models like the Austin and the Bronte were too complicated, and people just laughed at the suffragette, and the Virginia Woolf was way too far ahead of its time. So when I was born, there actually were only men. People were men. They all had one pronoun, his pronoun. So that's who I am. I am the generic he, as in, if anybody needs an abortion, he will have to go to another state. Or, a writer knows which side his bread is buttered on. That's me, the writer, him. I am a man. Not maybe a first-rate man. I'm perfectly willing to admit that I may be, in fact, a kind of second-rate or imitation man, a pretend-a-him. As a him, I am to a genuine male him, as a microwaved fish stick is to a whole grilled Chinook salmon. I mean, after all, can I inseminate? Can I belong to the Bohemian Club? Can I run General Motors? Theoretically, I can, but you know where theory gets us. Not to the top of General Motors. And then, I can't write my name with P in the snow, or it would be awfully laborious if I did. I can't shoot my wife and children and some neighbors and then myself. Oh, to tell you the truth, I can't even drive. I never got my license. I chickened out. I take the bus. That is terrible. I admit it. I am actually a very poor imitation or substitute man. And you could see it when I tried to wear those army surplus clothes with ammunition pockets that were trendy, and I looked like a hen in a pillowcase. I am shaped wrong. People are supposed to be lean. You can't be too thin. Everybody says so. People are supposed to be lean and taut, because that's how men generally are, lean and taut. Or anyhow, that's how a lot of men start out, and some of them even stay that way. And men are people. People are men. That has been well established. And so people, real people, the right kind of people, are lean. But I'm really lousy at being people, because I'm not lean at all, but sort of podgy, with actual fat places. I am untaught. And then people are supposed to be tough. Tough is good. But I've never been tough. I'm sort of soft, and actually sort of tender, like a good steak, or like Chinook salmon, which isn't lean and tough, but very rich and tender. But then, salmon aren't people. Or anyhow, we have been told that they aren't in recent years. We have been told that there is only one kind of people, and they are men. And I think it is very important that we all believe that. It certainly is important to the men. What it comes down to, I guess, is that I am just not manly, like Ernest Hemingway was manly. The beard and the guns and the wives and the little short sentences. I do try. I have this sort of beardoid thing that keeps trying to grow 9 or 10 hairs on my chin, sometimes even more. But what do I do with the hairs? I tweak them out. Would a man do that? Men don't tweak. Men shave. Anyhow, white men shave, being hairy. And I have even less choice about being white or not than I do about being a man or not. I am white whether I like being white or not. The doctors can do nothing for me. But I do my best not to be white, I guess, under the circumstances, since I don't shave. I tweak. But it doesn't mean anything, because I don't really have a real beard that amounts to anything. And I don't have a gun, and I don't have even one wife, and my sentences tend to go on and on and on with all this syntax in them. Ernest Hemingway would have died rather than have syntax. Or semicolons. I use a whole lot of half-assed semicolons. There was one of them, just now. And another thing, Ernest Hemingway would have died rather than get old. And he did. He shot himself. A short sentence. Anything rather than a long sentence. A life sentence. Death sentences are short and very, very manly. Life sentences aren't. They go on and on, all full of syntax and qualifying clauses and confusing references and getting old. And that brings up the real proof of what a mess I have made of being a man. I am not even young. Just about the time they finally started inventing women, I started getting old, and I went right on doing it, shamelessly. I have allowed myself to get old and haven't done one single thing about it, with a gun or anything. What I mean is, if I had any real self-respect, wouldn't I at least have had a facelift or some liposuction? Although liposuction sounds to me like what they do a lot of on TV when they are young or youngish, though not when they are old, and when one of them is a man and the other a woman, though not under any other circumstances. What they do is, this young or youngish man and woman take hold of each other and slide their hands around on each other, and then they perform liposuction. You are supposed to watch them while they do it. They move their heads around and flatten out their mouth and nose on the other person's mouth and nose and open their mouths in different ways, and you are supposed to feel sort of hot or wet or something as you watch. What I feel is like I'm watching two people doing liposuction. And this is why they finally invented women? Surely not. As a matter of fact, I think sex is even more boring as a spectator sport than all the other spectator sports, even baseball. If I am required to watch a sport instead of doing it, I'll take show jumping. The horses are really good looking. The people who ride them are mostly these sort of Nazis, but like all Nazis, they are only as powerful and successful as the horse they are riding. And it is, after all, the horse who decides whether to jump that five-barred gate or stop short and let the Nazi fall off over its neck. Only, usually the horse doesn't remember it has the option. Horses aren't awfully bright. But in any case, show jumping and sex have a good deal in common, though you can usually only get show jumping on American TV if you can pick up a Canadian channel, which is not true of sex. Given the option, though I often forget that I have an option, I certainly would watch show jumping and do sex, never the other way around. But I'm too old now for show jumping, and as for sex, who knows? I do. You don't. Of course, golden oldies are supposed to jump from bed to bed these days, just like horses jumping the five-barred gates. Bounce, bounce, bounce. But a good deal of this super sex at 70 business seems to be theory again, like the woman CEO of General Motors. Theory is invented mostly to reassure people in their 40s, that is, men, who are worried. That is why we had Karl Marx and why we still have economists, though we seem to have lost Karl Marx. As such, theory is dandy. As for practice, or praxis, as the Marxists used to call it, apparently because they liked X's, you wait till you are 60 or 70, and then you can tell me about your sexual practice, or praxis, if you want to, though I make no promises that I will listen. And if I do listen, I will probably be extremely bored and start looking for some show jumping on the TV. In any case, you are not going to hear anything from me about my sexual practice or praxis, then, now, or ever. But all that aside, here I am, old. When I wrote this, I was 60 years old, a 60-year-old smiling public man, as Yeats said. But then he was a man, and now I am over 70, and it's all my own fault. I get born before they invent women, and I live all these decades trying so hard to be a good man that I forget all about staying young, and so I didn't. And my tenses get all mixed up. I just am young. And then all of a sudden I was 60, and maybe 80. And what next? Not a whole lot. I keep thinking there must have been something that a real man could have done about it. Something short of guns, but more effective than oil of Olay. But I failed. I did nothing. I absolutely failed to stay young. And then I look back on all my strenuous efforts, because I really did try. I tried hard to be a man, to be a good man, and I see how I failed at that. I am at best a bad man, an imitation, phony, second-rate him with a 10-hair beard and semicolons. And I wonder, what was the use? Sometimes I think I might just as well give the whole thing up. Sometimes I think I might just as well exercise my option, stop short in front of the 5-barred gate, and let the Nazi fall off onto his head. If I'm no good at pretending to be a man, and no good at being young, I might just as well start pretending that I am an old woman. I'm not sure that anybody has invented old women yet, but it might be worth trying. That was an Ursula Le Guin performance piece, introducing myself, very slightly adapted by me. You can find it online or in her collection, The Wave in the Mind.
That's the Old Mole Variety Hour for March 7th, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Before we go, a reminder, KBOO is in the middle of the All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. Find out more about all the specials at kboo.fm/thrills. KBOO is a commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio station, and we're made possible by people just like you, and you can help us reach our $15,000 fundraising goal by going to kboo.fm/give. Or you can text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting both KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour. And thanks to Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, Norm Diamond, and Patricia Kohlberg, and their guests David Finkel and Grace Dillon. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. One last reminder, support KBOO right now by texting KBOO to 44321 or visit kboo.fm/give.